It is 11:15:20. What has a theology to say when it's time approaching to lunch? What can we say from our faith perspective when our stomachs are dictating our mind? I should think in something very interesting, creative, to compete with empty stomachs, to the roof of the empty stomachs. Maybe something tasty, spicy, provocative. Food for thoughts. Why I'm evoking empty stomachs at this zweite swishing roof? Because I believe that theology, faith, has to do with our bodies. Our bodies with pains, pleasures, rigid thoughts, our liquid feelings are influencing, are shaping. Shaping is a good word to discuss bodies and theology. Are shaping our grammar of faith, how we talk about faith, our arguments about theology. Una teología del cuerpo in Spanish, or a teología do corpo in Portuguese, an embodied theology, which is more than a theology of the body, but it's a theology that is in dialogue with body. What does it mean? I have learned from a feminist theologian, Catholic nun, called Yvonne Gebara, that a theology must talk to the ordinary things, to the daily life, to things that are common in our daily life. What has the body to do with the way we reflect about our faith? We give our sick sense, and this is how I define faith or theology, is that movement is seeking for sense in life. Or how do we exercise our spirituality? An embodied theology is about God incarnating, and it's a very beautiful sound in Latin, carne is flesh, incarnating in our world. God is coming to our world, which teaches us about vulnerability. We are vulnerable. Incarnation is God's option to be vulnerable in a world that is striving for power, security, and perfection. Hunger, vulnerable bodies, suffering, violence, exploitation, bodies that are commodities, define the way we reflect about God, about justice, about salvation, about dignity. Those are theological words that are connecting justice, dignity, peace with development. A table with plenty and a variety of food with equal access to those who have hunger is a very beautiful image for our churches and theology. It's a very beautiful way to discuss about solidarity, about power, and about structures of aid, development, and so on. A theology of good living, which in the Andean region is called El Buen Vivir, is a theology of a healthy and dignified bodies. To do a theology from our context and from our bodies is an invitation then to rearrange, to do in another structure, our way of thinking about God, of thinking about church, of thinking about faith. It is a movement that will have consequences in how we arrange our church, our communities, our organizations, how we define community, or how we define humanitarian aid, international cooperation. And it is in this way that theologians and churches can contribute to the discussion about religion and development. Our contribution should be not only because churches have the capacity to be in each village, to go in each town, in the most remote town, you have a church, you have a pastor going. It is because of the capacity to weave words, to articulate hope, to ensure sense of life. It is because of the role, this role that religion can play in building peace, just and dignified bodies and societies. Borrowing again articulation, a poet theology that is done by a Brazilian theologian called Ruben Alves. He is saying that religion is a language. It is a way to talk about the world. In everything, the presence of hope and sense of life. This is religion, presence of hope and sense of life. Religion is the tapestry that we hope weaves with words. And it's on these nets, which in Portuguese and in Spanish it's called redes, which is also the word for hammocks, which is a beautiful image. On these nets, people will rest, lay down in that tapestry we've woven together with hope and sense of life. This is religion. There people can rest, can lay, can put their own life. How these, Ruben Alves is asking, how these words are woven together? With desire. El deseo. Desire. This is the way that hopes, words are woven together. Desire can do everything. Everything can be done with those words and desires. Those nets can be places of fear, places that produce death. Or they can be places that produce hope, movements of justice and dignity. This is the public role of faith and religion everywhere, in Brazil, in Nigeria, in Mali, in Switzerland. It enables people to ask for their own rights. This is to empower, is to overcome those nets of fear. This is the role of religion, is to empower people to be agents, citizens, to take their lives in their own hands.
Herzlichen Dank. Mit der Verletzlichkeit der Menschen, mit der Verletzlichkeit unserer Körper treten wir in einen anderen Kontext ein, den Kontext von Nigeria. Vieles, was in Papieren der Entwicklungszusammenarbeit und Entwicklungsagenturen herumschwirrt, viele Vorstellungen von Entwicklung, viele administrative Erfordernisse, welche im Entwicklungsbetrieb vorherrschend sind, wirken in Nigeria absurd. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Jakubu Joseph bei uns zu Gast ist heute. Ist eine Ehre, dass Sie gekommen sind. Und übrigens, ganz wichtig, Jakubu Joseph. Ich wechsle selbst immer wieder zu Joseph Jakubu. Es ist Jakubu Joseph, der Name, genau. Ist Landeskoordinator von Mission 21 in Nigeria und hat sich in seiner Doktorarbeit intensiv mit der Entwicklungszusammenarbeit aus der Perspektive von Afrika auseinandergesetzt. Er hat sehr viel Praxiserfahrung, aber hat auch sehr viel reflektiert über das, was da alles geschieht. Mit uns wird er seine Gedanken zum Thema jenseits der Budgets, eine Suche nach dem Preis internationaler Zusammenarbeit teilen. Ganz herzlich willkommen. Bitte, Jakubu.
I bring you special greetings from Nigeria, from our church, the Church of the Brethren, and from friends and family who knew that I would be coming here. They said, I should bring greetings to you. This is how we do it in Nigeria. When you are traveling, they will give you a sack of greetings to carry and deliver. So I feel light now that I have. I would like to thank the two first speakers for their presentations. And I want to also thank Mark specifically for setting the stage. I think you have made my job more complicated. Your presentation has delved into the very heart of the debate on aid. And what I seek to achieve this afternoon is basically to bring a different voice, to bring the perspective of the Global South, and once again, another misrepresentation. The Global South is not one, monolithic, population. We are very diverse, from Latin America, parts of Southeast Asia, Africa, very, very diverse. So when we talk about developing countries, we're talking about a very diverse part of the world. And when we talk about this southern hemisphere, we are also talking about a region that is very diverse. Africa as well. We have different levels of development. For too long, the debate about aid has been monopolized by voices from the West. And the reason is not far-fetched. We receive aid. We are the recipients. So we don't have a voice. There is already a power asymmetry because the person who gives has power. The person who receives does not have power. And this is why you hardly hear voices of people from the South in the debate about AIDS. And the focus of the debate has always been on budget. Should we reduce the budget? Should we increase it? And we are at the mercies and caprices of this Western debate about aid. Now, I think there is a big gap. When we talk about aid, international aid or international development, are we talking about the same thing? Are we really talking about the same thing? In my opinion, there is a need to deconstruct what we mean by international development. From the perspective that I'm coming from, the debate about aid cannot be reduced to just numbers. Aid is more than just numbers. Yes. And since you have provoked us to think theologically, I want to give you this illustration. Yes, the word of God is free, isn't it? Is the word of God not free? I'm asking. Is the word of God not free? It's free, right? Is the word of God free? I want to hear an answer from you. Let's interact. The word of God is free, but you need money to buy Bible. So my assertion that we should be talking not only about budgets does not mean the budget is not important. You need money to be able to accomplish the objectives of international development. So the budget is important, but the conversation should not just be about budgets. There is a certain implication about talking only on the budgets. The implication here is that there is a kind of rational assessment of the value of development, international development. Does it make sense that we are spending this percentage of our gross national product? Or it does not. And we have seen, first, the debate about aid, the relevance of aid, became very strong in the light of what people saw as a continuous dependence or dependent of people from regions that are poor. Recipient countries continue to depend on aid time and again. And so when are they going to be weaned off development aid? There is a fatigue. And are we creating dependence? Are we carrying these developing countries on our shoulder? I think time has come that they have got to be on their feet. Some argue that way. Others argue that we have got enough problem domestically to deal with, and therefore, we need to also take care of our own issues. We are being benevolent. We are trying to help. But we have issues. We have even poverty within, maybe not quite in Switzerland. And even sometimes the poverty can become invisible. It may exist, but it can become invisible to you. I have lived in Germany for several years, and I do know a lot of working families that are struggling. But the way we measure poverty also is quite different. So we discuss about the budget. Let's reduce the budget. Now, my argument is that the more we are discussing about development budget, the more we are talking about what are we getting from it. And so some have said, like the European Union model has been, let's attach aid and trade. I was part of the negotiations with the European Union in Nigeria, then with ECOWAS, talking about economic partnership agreements, EPAs. And it looked to us in, you know, in Africa that we are giving aid with one hand and you are taking with the other hand. Because you see great imbalance in the proposal that is given to us in the Economic Partnership Agreement. For that reason, some countries like Nigeria told the European Union, we need to study the EPAs. We want to see what are the social development indicators built into this agreement. But the European Union said, if you are asking this question, we find states, we will not negotiate with you as a bloc if you are not ready. We find states that we will have this negotiation. So they went to some states in West Africa. They signed this economic partnership agreement instead of negotiating with a bloc, West Africa. But eventually the discussions went on. Besides using aid also as a negotiation tool, aid has also been used as a way to address some of the domestic problems that are here, such as migration. Okay, if we can just give them something to take care of the problem there, we will reduce the number of people that are coming to our countries. I'm not going to question the wisdom in that, but I think that the problem of migration cannot be solved by only this measure. Now, what I believe development aid is all about is that development aid is an expression of international solidarity. We have a practice in Nigeria, and I think most parts of Africa. If I go to a city and I need a place to stay, and I have a wealthy relative or a wealthy friend, before I decide where to stay, I will ask myself, who accepts me as a person? In Africa, we don't just take the assistance that is given to us. We look at the question of human dignity. If you don't accept us as people with dignity, we say, keep whatever you have. We'll be willing to die. If you don't accept us as people, if you don't actually see us as people who have dignity, keep your aid. So if I go to a city, I don't go to an uncle who is wealthy if he does not accept me as a person. I'd rather go to a friend who accepts me as a person and sleep on the floor with him. Because I think the whole idea of aid presents a picture of a recipient who is so helpless, has no dignity, and is given whatever is presented. And I see that as opposed to the principle of international solidarity. What is that principle of international solidarity built on? What is the philosophy behind it? The philosophy behind it is that we are all part of the human family. Regardless of your color, your race, your religion, your sex, we are all part of the human family. And for us, when you bring rich Western countries, and we are so grateful to Switzerland, because you are always ahead when it comes to international aid, as we have heard from Mark. Even though the tone of the debate is changing here. And thank you, people like Mark, who are really trying to take the government to tax to understand the reality of international development. You as a country are always ahead. You are always willing to share with us. But we receive this aid because we believe we are part of the human family. In my role as the coordinator of Mission 21 in Nigeria, I meet people that have been affected by conflict. I go to poor communities, and we try to come in to support their effort to improve their own situations. And what I get from them, each time we go, either with my colleague Uli, or last 2 weeks, when the head of institutional partnership of the SDC visited our program in Nigeria, the children came and all clustered him. The women were singing and dancing. They said, "We have received encouragement by this visit. Your coming has shown that we are not in this problem alone." So international development is about solidarity. You cannot afford to say, "We will not do anything for you anymore." Once you do that, you have severed our interconnectedness as part of the human family. And this is what I want us to also bring to the table in this debate. There is no way you can have food to eat and you know your neighbor is going hungry and you don't do anything about it. Even among people that are in displaced camps, like refugees and IDP, internally displaced persons, they are sharing. One of the teachers we are working with to help to bring literacy to women, because the women, since Boko Haram has attacked our schools, abducted our girls, women are saying, "We also want to go to school, not only our daughters, but we want to also read and write." One of the teachers, himself a displaced person, uses money from his pocket also to buy writing materials for these women. And he offers his time free of charge. So when we are reporting about development effectiveness, we hardly factor in these contributions that people make about their situation. The EYN Church has said, if we only wait on the support that comes from outside, we will not have been alive by this time. So whatever is coming is augmenting the kind of efforts that people also are making to support themselves. One of the leaders that we met with the SDC official 2 weeks ago told us that we are very hardworking people. We hate to beg. All we are trying to do is to see that we get the kind of support that helps us to stand on our feet. Development cooperation must include strategies to empower people, to get people not to become perpetually dependent, but to be able to stand on their feet. Oftentimes, development agencies come with money. If you suggest something that helps you to stand on your feet, they don't want it. They don't want it. Because there is, it makes more impact, more publicity to show a picture of people queuing up with plates to collect food than to show young people receiving tools to start carpentry workshop, to start all welding and tailoring, women going into different businesses. And we have come to realize that one of the critical areas that we need to invest is in livelihoods development. One way to address poverty in Africa is to go invest in livelihood development. So much money is coming. There is also poor targeting. Here you conceive what sectors you want your money to go into, and oftentimes we are not making input into that kind of decision. That's what we're talking about, development effectiveness. For development to become effective, the people have to have a say. And by the way, the bigger the European NGOs, the less likely they are willing to listen to us when they come. They don't listen to us. And this is a big question. I've talked about international solidarity, which is based on the philosophy of interconnectedness. You know what? If we were to be in your shoes, or even at the present level of economic development that we are, and if you were to be in need, and we can help you even a little, we will be very happy to do that. For those of you who have worked in Africa, you have seen a woman willing to give you from the peanuts that she harvested, she's willing to share with you. Some are willing to share their beans with you. Some are willing to open their doors. You don't need special invitation to come to our house to eat. We are willing to share. But we don't have the kind of economic power that you have to give you. If we have, we'll give you. If tomorrow you get into the situation that you need help, we'll give you. We don't pray that you get into that situation. We'll give you because we're part of this one human family. So those who are talking about whether to stop aid completely or to shrink the budget, I think should be better educated on this philosophy of interconnectedness. That is the essence of international solidarity. It is this sense of interconnectedness that has made you a member of the international community, that you sign treaties, you sign conventions, you're part of the development of certain development goals or targets like the MDGs, which ended in 2015, and now we have the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. You are part of this initiative. It is based on the recognition that what affects the South affects the West. We are all on one planet. If you don't understand that principle, then come and learn it from natural law. I'm talking about climate change. We all know how our fate is tied together. Our fates are tied together. Climate change, global warming, is affecting all of us. Here, the pollution, the depletion of the ozone layer because of your level of industrialization is causing impact on our countries, on our continent. And we have the least ability to cope. We are more vulnerable. The last speaker talked about vulnerability. So we are connected. The many cars, the many things that give you this luxury that you enjoy, that many of our young people are eager to come here, that is attracting our young people, is impacting on our small farmers. It means we're in this boat together. And because we're in this boat together, we have to all make a contribution to solve this problem, these global problems, this universal problem of climate change affects all of us. And it has to be a proportionate contribution. Your contribution has to be relative to your strength. I don't expect Switzerland to make the same contribution as the Gambia because of your different relative strengths. But what affects this part of the world affects that part of the world. We are in this boat together. And this is what our politicians need to understand, that we need to come together. We are also united by universal values, such as human rights. Since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, the world has signified its commitment, its concern about human rights, not only here in Switzerland, but you are concerned about human rights in other parts of the world. And that means your investment in the fight against human rights violation in any part of the world is an investment in the fight against human rights violation in the whole world. If the right of one child is violated in any part of the world, I feel that my right has been violated. The way women are treated in our country, in my country, and in some regions of the world is not acceptable. If you are part of that human family, you share the value of gender equality, that all of us are created in the image of God and we are the same, male or female. And therefore, we must work for the promotion of these universal values, which some have been codified in conventions and covenants that many of our countries are signatories to. We must commit our resources. This is a worthwhile investment. It's not a question of whether you like it or you don't like it. If you sign out, it means you do not share in these universal values. I also want to talk about some of the approaches where we need, some of the areas we need a lot of investment. Many of our societies are either affected by conflict or are coming out of conflict. Please don't forget that here in Europe, you were once also affected by conflict. Germany, there were refugees. 8 million Germans had to return back to Germany. People were looking for what to eat. And the Swiss, you stood and you supported them. Why did you do that? It's because you're caring people. It's because you understand this humanitarian imperative of helping a person in need. This is why you have created something that is a gift to the world, the Red Cross. And we are grateful for the services of what you have created. You might have heard that the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Swiss government contributed in the negotiation that led to the release of 21 Chibok school girls that were abducted. 20 out of the 21 girls are from my church, the EYN Church, the Church of the Brethren. We are very grateful. It is their commitment to the human value of the sanctity of human life, regardless of whose life is taken. And you cannot afford to turn your eyes away. I was making a presentation and I was asked, how does your government handle some of these issues? Some of our governments do not consider the life of the citizen as that important. If I abduct you, the whole Swiss Federation may come to a standstill. If you come to Nigeria, something happens to you. All these diplomatic resources and the assets, security assets, and might of the Swiss Federation will be brought to bear to secure you are released. Our governments don't care sometimes. 10 people are killed, we move on. Tomorrow, 20 people, it's okay. And therefore, when you stand with us, you give us hope, and you make our governments to know also that the international community is concerned about what happens. And we're hoping that the Swiss government, the International Committee of the Red Cross, will continue to help in negotiating with Boko Haram to secure the release of the other girls. This is an example for us of international development. This is an example of the kind of resources that has been used that maybe the media is not reporting. So we must talk about diversity of strategies. We need institution building. Part of our problem is that we don't have strong institutions. I live in Germany. We hardly talk about Angela Merkel. In Nigeria, when somebody steals money, $1, people will talk about where is the president. But in here in Europe, you have systems that work. So development cooperation should help us really to build strong institutions. We also need to strengthen civil society. We have come to realize that just depending on service delivery, you come with money, help to build wells, schools, hospitals. That is very good, but it's not enough. It has to be complemented by what we call a right-based approach, which means we need to build the capacity of civil society so that people can hold their governments accountable, so that we make sure that the governments are using the budget and using it also to invest in social development. And lots of initiatives have come up like that, like the fight against corruption. Many civil society coalitions have been established to fight corruption. Some are talking about electoral reforms. You have one of the most advanced democracies in the world, deliberative democracy, 100,000 signatures. You'll have an issue taken up by your parliament. I used to say that the Swiss democracy or the Swiss Federation is even on autopilot because you don't have a president. Because the institutions are working. Yeah. That is not the case. We are talking about in Nigeria, Buhari. So one person cannot make it happen. We need institutions where everybody is going to be accountable. So, international development must also invest in building local infrastructure that will help us to make sure that the government is working. So, I want to conclude with this message. Budgets. I said, I think there was a misstep in the translation. Let's look beyond the budget. Aid, international cooperation is too important to be reduced to just the budgets. Now, I say we should not only talk about the price, but we should talk about the price of development cooperation. I think the spelling was mixed up a little bit. When you run a race, when you run a contest, at the end of the day, you receive what? A reward. It's called a prize. Instead of talking about the price, the cost of international development, we should what? Gauge the price against the prize. What are we getting? The price of international development is that today we are better human beings. If you want to look at it empirically, Mark has talked about this. The World Bank has statistics. There is overwhelming evidence that since 1945, when the so-called modern development was born, we have made significant progress. There are diseases that have been eliminated. We are even trying to get rid of polio. We have people, more and more people have been lifted out of poverty. More and more people have access to education. In more places, the rights of women has improved. You can measure that through the Gini coefficient. We've seen all these improvements. But beyond that, it has brought the best in us as human beings who are members of this planet, this family on this planet, that we are in this ship together. We are not island of countries, but we are connected. And this is what development cooperation has done to us. It has brought the best of human beings. Not, oh yeah, Israel, everyone to your tent. But we stand shoulder to shoulder with each other. You are standing with the Syrian people. You are standing with the Iraqi people. You are standing with people from Eastern Europe. We know that your capacity is finite. And definitely you have to take some measures to say, this is how much we can take. But do not forget that this is about the very essence of who we are as a human family. Development cooperation, also many people who have experienced development cooperation by going to recipient countries have come back with stories that have transformed their lives. I will give you an example of someone that Mission 21 took to Nigeria for an assessment. And we met the parents of the Chibok girls, the mothers and fathers of the Chibok girls. And this person is from Switzerland, a very good person. But he said, I don't practice religion. When he met the parents of the Chibok girls, I was with him, and a German pastor, all of us broke down. And this person, who does not belong to any religion, who is from the Red Cross, said to us, I was not ready for this. This has broken me. Now, when I go back, I have 3 daughters. I'm imagining how I would have felt if my daughters were taken. But the way I see you parents still putting your hope in your God and standing strong, if ever anything happens to me again, I'll remember you and remember how I see you coping, and that will encourage me. Development cooperation is about experience. Come and experience it. Don't just sit down somewhere and be wiring money. The head of the Swiss Development Cooperation Institutional Partnership came down for the first time he was in Nigeria. He ate nothing but Nigerian food. He saw the bad road that we go through. He met the children, he held them, the women. He has experienced it firsthand. There is no text that can give him that, the kind of feeling that he had by experiencing. Development cooperation creates fellowship. So we should be talking about development partnership, that we are all partners in this, that we are being impacted by the people that we work with. And of course, there is no donor, no recipient. After all, both of us are donors and both of us are recipients. The problem with the Western rational approach is that money, because actually the mistake was when development was born, after the Second World War, they created institutions like the World Bank. And therefore, money became a prominent feature of the international development. But we cannot measure development only in terms of money. You are also receiving. You are receiving from the people that you are giving. Development must be give and take. You are receiving. Let me share the last story with you. In the early 1990s, I was working for the Mennonite Central Committee, and my colleague was finishing his term and going back to Canada. He was furious because he left his money with his elder brother, but the elder brother squandered it. He went back to Canada ready to take everything that the elder brother had. He went with a truck and he drove to his elder brother's house and he wanted to empty it. And he stopped there and broke into tears and said, "What did I learn from the poor people that I work with in Nigeria? They had nothing, but they were willing to give. Thank you very much."
Just a moment. Yes, thank you very much. I was not able to cut. I'm very sorry for the many questions that are in the public, I'm sure. But at least two or three little short questions, that must be possible. Please. But not questions of understanding, but questions of dialogue with this very engaged speech of yours. Please.
Well, first of all, I would like to return the favor and say thank you for this brilliant presentation. I had a very interesting conversation about 2 weeks ago with another person from Nigeria who basically told me, why don't you just keep your aid? Give us back all the money that is deposited somewhere in Swiss banks. Keep your Swiss companies from exploiting Nigeria and its resources without paying any taxes, because your aid is not an expression of solidarity, it's an expression of guilt. And it helps you to forget that you're actually stealing from our country. You're stealing illicit funds, you're stealing taxes, and development cooperation, even though you call it cooperation, is just aid that makes you forget all the guilt that you have in other parts of, let's say, economic life. Personally, in my opinion, one does not exclude the other. You can still do development cooperation and give back the money that it's deposited in Switzerland. But I guess the question is, what is the general sentiment in Nigeria when it comes to Switzerland's contribution in development?
Thank you. Other questions? Other burning issues? So this is a big question.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark. I think that it was a minor. I mean, this is the minority opinion, I would say, that you hear. There are people who have even sense of entitlement, like, okay, they subscribe to anti-modernization theorists. They come from a post-colonial school of thought that during colonialism, you have taken so much from us, and I'm not making specific reference to Switzerland, but that Western countries have taken so much from us and they should give us back. I think for me that is a historical analysis. This does not take into account the fact that colonialism has both bad and good sides. And it's so difficult really to determine and say, oh, you are owing us anything. I think we have gone beyond that in most recent debates and literature. I've not seen that kind of debate of entitlement, you know, give us back what you have taken. But of course, when it comes to the issue of the money in Swiss banks, this is something that is still being discussed. As one particular example is the Abacha loot. And the Swiss government has returned some of that money. And there is a process. So the Swiss government doesn't want to give back the money that some politicians have stolen and brought here. And then other politicians can steal it. So they work with the World Bank. They identify, for example, critical infrastructure where this money can be invested. And the federal government, the Federal Ministry of Finance of Nigeria, takes this money, and under the strict guidance and supervision of the World Bank, they take care of certain infrastructural needs. And the Swiss government has indicated also that whatever money that is here has been stashed away by our politicians will be returned through appropriate channels. So this is going on. And I'm also aware that the Swiss banks have been also put under greater scrutiny now. There have been also some restrictions on the banks, so that will not encourage people to just come and snatch out away their money here. Back home, we also have a system now. A lot of financial restrictions that make it difficult for people to have their money, to take our money away. Tax justice is part of it. So we also are part of development cooperation, contributes to the awareness about social justice. In fact, there are organizations in Switzerland that are talking about fair trade. They are talking about, you know, better deal for cocoa farmers. They are talking about tax that Swiss companies must be held, accountable, you know. And more and more Swiss people are, when they go to a supermarket, they want to see which company, how is the company socially responsible? Are they, you know, respecting environmental regulations, labor law? They are not using child labor and all that. I think we have to appreciate the progress that has been made, and we cannot turn the hand of history back. But really, we can build a better future. And so I don't see any need for anybody to feel guilty about the past. What happened in the past is not as simple as it can be explained by as some tend to explain it. So, but we can construct a better future, and that is the challenge. The thing about history is that you forget history, you don't know where you're going to. You hold on to history too much, you get nowhere. Yeah. So we have to make the right decision. Overwhelmingly, I can say, and I invite you to check, the opinion about Switzerland in the Nigerian public is favorable. And I say that because the Swiss government has not been dictating to us or interfering in our politics. Again, whatever is a good cause, you will find the Swiss government there. The Swiss agencies are there. And the Swiss agencies, the Swiss Development Corporation, all those agencies, organizations, and NGOs from Switzerland that are working in developing countries, they are the actual ambassadors of Switzerland, because they are representing Switzerland and their work is speaking for the country. The International Committee of the Red Cross is there, Mission 21, many organizations, I will not be able to mention all of them, are working on the ground and contributing to good causes.
Yeah. Thank you very much for this encouraging message. Thank you.
What to say when it's 12 o'clock? And after these two brilliant presentations from a perspective of religion, Mark and Joseph, you used the word connectedness, interconnectedness. Religion is this, religare. This is the role of religion. Reconnect the pain, the suffering of people here with the pain, the needs of suffering of people here. This is the role of religion, is religare, is do this work of ligare, connecting the needs, the suffering, and why not, the happiness that what we have achieved. It's to build community. And this is the net of solidarity. This is the place of solidarity. Eduardo Galeano, a Uruguayan writer, is bringing a two very different meanings of working with charity and solidarity. Charity is assuming that the world will continue to be unequal, is giving. I give something to someone who is in need. This is charity. It's not changing. Solidarity means to rebalance, to bring a new balance, to give and to receive. To give and receive is everywhere. You need to give and receive. And this is the balance of life. When you give and you receive, if you only give, you are in this balance. If you only receive, you are also. To bring back this power relation, this is solidarity. Religion will bring solidarity into practice in churches, in theology. This implies the openness of listening. And it must go together with the notion, the sense of justice. Justice is a prophetical, biblical concept. We can say we don't want to talk about equality, we don't want to talk about equal relationships. Churches cannot say that we don't want to talk about justice. It's biblical, it's prophetical. If we say that we don't want to talk about justice, we need to throw away the Bible. We are not church anymore. A theology must deal with justice. What is justice? How justice can be promoted in our giving and receiving? This must orient. And in that sense, a theology of justice will overcome the notion of guilty, but will bring responsibility. And these are the other two concepts that I think theologically we have been using in a wrong way when we talk about international aid or cooperation. Guilt is a theology of guilt. It's a theology of fear. We are doing things because we fear. A theology of responsibility is to take life in the hands, is to take responsibility. It's against the guilt. And that is the key to overcome this notion of guilty and responsibility, is to promote a theology of responsibility in solidarity. This is the task of churches. This is the task of theology, is to promote this kind of spirituality, to this kind of weaving words together that produce sense in life and to bring hope and to give hunger of justice. Let us sing together at this point. God bless to us our bread, and give bread to all, you can put the words, to all those who are hungry, and hunger of justice to those who are fed. God bless to us our bread. The words are there. Can you see? Can you read them? It's in Spanish, German. No, you cannot read them. Laura, bendice, no?
Dann singen wir es einmal auf Spanisch und versuchen es dann auf
I can say it then in Spanish, and you can repeat. I can say, bendice Señor nuestro pan. Y da pan a los que tienen hambre. Y hambre de justicia a los que tienen pan. Bendice Señor nuestro pan.
Bendice Señor nuestro pan. Y da pan a los que tienen hambre y hambre de justicia a los que tienen pan. Bendice Señor nuestro pan. Bendice Señor nuestro pan. Y da pan.
Das ist ja auch eine hoffnungsvolle Botschaft. Ich habe noch eine etwas komplizierte Mitteilung in Bezug auf den Nachmittag. Folgendes: Die Workshops 1, Steueroase oder globale Verantwortung, 5, Recht und Risiko und 7, Gemeindepartnerschaften, die wurden gestrichen, nicht aus Bosheit unsererseits, sondern weil es schlicht keine Anmeldungen dazu gab. Ich hoffe, dass von den verlorenen Anmeldungen da nicht noch irgendwelche dabei sind. Aber grundsätzlich hat es da einfach keine Anmeldungen gehabt. Also die sind gestrichen. Die Workshops beginnen um 13.30 Uhr in den jeweiligen Räumen. Bitte schaut doch draußen, sind die Angaben, wo die Workshops stattfinden. Eine Ausnahme gibt es, um es kompliziert zu machen. Der Workshop 8 auf den Spuren schwarzer Geschäfte mit, so wie ich verstanden habe, Karl Johannes Rechsteiner, der da durch die Stadt führen wird, der beginnt bereits um 13.15 Uhr. Workshop 8 um 13.15 Uhr, da muss es also etwas schneller gehen. Und die Leute, die im Workshop 8 sind, haben die Lizenz, vorzudrängeln beim Essen. Macht doch bitte Gebrauch davon. Also Workshop 8, möglichst schauen, dass ihr schnell da beim Essen seid, damit dann das nicht ein Gedränge gibt. Nach den Workshops sollten alle etwa ab 3 Uhr Pause haben und um 20 nach 3 treffen wir uns alle wieder hier, das ist auch im Programm so festgehalten. Um 20 nach 3, also nachdem alle schon auch Kaffee und alles getrunken haben, treffen wir uns wieder hier und das Programm geht weiter. Eine gute Miteinander.